Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage as we travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, columnist for the Anchorage Daily News and host of Alaska Edition and Running on Alaska Public Media, Michael Carey. The Alaska Professional Communicators hosted Michael's talk entitled, Everyone You Meet Is Your Teacher, What the Buddha Taught an Alaska Newspaper Man, recorded at Kinley's Restaurant in Anchorage on January 9th.
Hi, I am here to introduce our guest speaker today and the very first editor I ever had in my whole life who explained to me that you can't write a column of 2,000 words. You actually have to edit yourself. Thank you, Michael. I thought every word was golden. Okay, our guest speaker today is Michael Carey, who was born and raised in Fairbanks. He graduated from Lathrop High School and went to earn his bachelor's degree from Ithaca College and do graduate work at Duke University. For most of the late 60s and into the 70s, he lived in New York City before returning to Alaska and entering the newspaper business. Michael was a member of the Anchorage Daily News editorial page staff before becoming a columnist. Many of you will recognize Michael as host of Public Broadcasting's Alaska Edition, a must-see if you want to know what's going on. I love that show. It's a political analysis show that has been on the air for the past decade. So please join me now in welcoming Michael Carey.
Why is the title for this talk, Everyone You Meet Is Your Teacher? Because the Buddha said, everyone you meet is your teacher, and the Buddha was right. There are some people you would prefer to meet only once. They wear out their welcome immediately, but they are sort of an exclamation mark on the Buddha's words. So I'm going to talk about people I met and what I learned, keeping in mind the Buddha also said everything you meet is your teacher. When I received the invitation to come here, I became apprehensive. I started thinking about my appearance before you, and I remembered how the newspapers of my childhood, the 50s, would have described an event like this. And then the old sourdough began to reminisce. He would have been appearing before the local historical society, or perhaps just holding court at the Nordale Hotel, where perhaps a dozen young men would gather around to hear all those stories of great snowfalls and howling huskies. I hope that having seen my gray hair and knowing that I'm approaching 70, the audience doesn't think I crossed the Chilkoot Pass in 98 or was on hand when Soapy Smith was gunned down in Skagway. But I am old enough to have known men who lived through the gold rush. Clarence Boatman, for one, spelled just like it sounds, Boatman. Boatman was born in 1866 and could remember the Custer Massacre of 1876. In fact, he'd been in the cavalry in the late 1880s and 90s in Montana. My dad, Fabian, took me to meet him when I was about 7. I thought I was going to meet John Wayne, the image of a cavalryman in my head. I met a stooped, tired, failing old man living in a small cabin. I tried not to squirm with boredom during the visit as I wondered when Fabian would break off the conversation with, time to take the kid home, sourdough. While the men conversed, I let my eyes wander the cabin until they reached the most arresting item in the room, a large calendar from a stateside fur buyer that was nailed to the wall. The fur buyer urged trappers to ship him their prime pelts and enjoy his prime prices. These calendars were standard features of interior decoration in territorial Alaska. They were prints of dramatic frontier scenes originally painted in oil. For example, a buckskin-clad trapper, rifle raised over his head as a club, in mortal combat with an enraged grizzly bear. On calendars of yesteryear, grizzly bears came in only one size, extra large. Fabian wasn't lying to me when he told me the visit would take just a minute, and it lasted all afternoon. Inevitably, once the old-timer began describing early Alaska under Fabian's hearty encouragement, There was one more trapping or dog mushing story to tell, one more cup of coffee to pour, one more stick of birch to throw on the fire. The past was so seductive, and the atmosphere in which the men explored history was so comfortable, time became immaterial to them. As a graduate student, long, long afterward, I thought these visits were my first history tutorials. After I became white-haired like old boatmen, I realized the history lessons were of less importance than the example Fabian set for me. Friendship requires nurture, and you nurture friendship with the simplest of gifts, your time. I have been a reader since early childhood, and I began reading newspapers as soon as I could hold them. Newspapers have been important in shaping me. They were my teachers. I lived in New York City for a year and a half when I was 9 to 10 and read the tabloid press, especially the Mirror and the New York Daily News. I love these papers because I had the vocabulary mostly to read them. They specialized in crime, war, you read the same papers, Elise read the same papers, celebrity and sports. There were words I understood but could not pronounce. I understood that in international relations and then the clubhouses of the Major League ball games, there was a lot of intrigue, but I could not pronounce it. For me, it was intergu. There was intergu everywhere. I also, looking back, I found a headline that I loved from that period. The headline from one of the tabs in New York was, "Long Island killer adjudicated nuts." And what I love about this is the combination of high diction adjudicated and low diction nuts. I went back to Fairbanks as a kid where I read Jessen's Weekly and the News Miner. The News Miner was conservative, Republican, pro-development, and a guy with it, my dad's politics didn't like it. So I grew up around people who didn't like the paper's Republican politics or the small town Chamber of Commerce boosterism Sinclair Lewis mocked. But as a historian and professional newspaperman, in other words, as an adult, I realized the News Miner in the 50s and 60s was really a very good paper. First of all, publisher Bill Snedden put a lot of money into the production. It was a nice looking paper, a pioneer in the use of color, won many awards, and the News Miner really did cover the community. If you want to know the history of Fairbanks in the 50s and the 60s, you have no better source than the News Miner. Snedden, and I really have to give him credit, wasn't afraid to cover unpalatable subjects. For example, crime. In the 50s, he believed the lawlessness of the Fairbanks bars was hurting the statehood clause. He wanted Fairbanks cleaned up, but he also reported what he saw. GI Payday was the most important day of the month for local merchants, especially the bar owners who catered to airmen from Ladd Air Force Base and Eielson. When the bars were full at night, the jails were crowded the following morning. Ted Stevens, who later served 4 decades in the U.S. Senate, was the federal district attorney in Fairbanks at the time. Ted soon discovered that his Harvard law degree had not prepared him for the challenges facing law enforcement in a frontier town where liquor and women were for sale 24 hours a day. Airmen, often fresh from basic training, and many of them were very young, this has been documented, were green as grass marks to the young woman who the bars advertised in the News Miner as beautiful hostesses. These working girls were not to be trifled with. The News Miner described a girl chasing a fleeing airman down a bar-lined street, firing a pistol at him as he struggled to pull up his trousers. The paper attributed the gunfire to, quote, a dispute over personal services. The News Miner under Snedden was so much better than earlier versions of the paper, and the paper at one time had been written owned by industrialist Cap Lathrop. Now, let me be fair to those earlier publishers and reporters. They had limited resources. My friend Dermot Cole, who worked for the News Miner for years, say what they would respond to my criticism of their newspapers with, "Hey, pal, so what do you want for a nickel?" That's what the paper sold in an earlier era. But here's an example of something they did that really irritated me to the point of driving me crazy. There was a big criminal trial in Fairbanks during World War I that involved scandalous charges against several prominent people. The trial went on for days. Here's the way the paper described the testimony. Jones testified for the prosecution. Jones advanced the prosecution's case. Wilson testified for the defense. Wilson advanced the defense's case. As a reader, almost 100 years later, I was almost weeping, begging, crying, please, could you just tell me what somebody said? What did these people say on the witness stand? But no, we just got to advance the case or set it back. Reading newspapers as a kid taught me the world is much, much bigger than what you are taught in your home and in school. And I didn't read just newspapers. As a teen, I read The Beats, Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac in particular, and novelist and essayist Norman Mailer. Ginsberg and Kerouac I knew through paperbacks, Mailer through his columns in the Village Voice. Mailer often wrote in a third-person voice that was very personal, as he was talking about the community, about politics, about relationships between the sexes, book reviews, whatever it was highly personal. But in these totally personal columns of Mailer, he was telling me, small town America doesn't have to be your life. I'm sort of amazed that anybody in Fairbanks, Alaska had a subscription to the Village Voice. Maybe the library did. I don't remember where we read it, but we did. Then there was Kerouac from his autobiographical On the Road, which made a huge impression on me, in which his characters, Sal Paradise and Dean Moriarty, race from one end of America to another in a frenzy. Where are we going, man? Sal asked Dean. Dean replies, I don't know, man, but we gotta go. This exchange captured my imagination, and I have really bad news for conservative America, which condemned Kerouac then and now for being sort of antisocial. Where are we going, man? I don't know, man, but we gotta go has become part of the American dream and will captivate young Americans as long as there is an America. And I do have one show and tell here. I don't have a presentation of video material, but I do have, this is my original copy of On the Road, which I've had for more than 50 years. On the back it says, this is the odyssey of the Beat Generation, the frenetic young men and their women restlessly racing from New York to San Francisco, from Mexico to New Orleans in a frantic search for kicks, that's an uppercase, and truth is an uppercase. And then they quote Time Magazine, a kind of literary James Dean, wolf-like and Whitman-esque. The radio was important as a source of information. I can remember listening to the Democratic Convention in 1960. This was my first serious exposure to electoral politics. I was very fortunate that my neighbor, Paul Blackwell, who was the father of two of my good friends, was somebody who was interested in politics and knew a lot about politics and guided me through some of this as we listened to John F. Kennedy being nominated on the radio in this very exciting moment. The radio was imperfect like the papers. Radio news was famous for rip and read. In one case, this was 1965, a DJ ripped an AP story off the teletype that was headlined, Black Nationalist Leader Malcolm X is Dead. The disc jockey rushed to the microphone, but read it as, Black Nationalist Leader Malcolm 10 is dead. Malcolm 10 is dead. I didn't join the Beats or attempt to follow in Norman Mailer's footsteps in fiction and in nonfiction. After a long sojourn, including years in New York City, I became a newspaper editor in Anchorage. Now, a newspaper editor, for all kinds of good reason, has a lot of contact with the public. He spends most of his day trying to get the paper out, but there's a lot of contact with the public. I was the editorial page ever. You have to deal with the public. So there were phone calls, and there was some of the more memorable ones, one like this. Phone rings, is this Michael Carey? Yes, it is. Are you from Fairbanks? Yes, I am. Was your dad Fabian Carey? Yes, he was. Did he work on Eielson Air Force Base in 1962? Oh, there's a real good chance he did. He was working out on those bases quite a lot during that time. Mr. Carey, I have something really, really important to tell you. What is that, sir? I know who killed John F. Kennedy. Really, no kidding, how do you know that? I was in New Orleans and I heard two men talking next to me in a a telephone booth, and they were discussing the assassination, and now I know how Kennedy was killed. I said, well, if you know that, why don't you call the FBI? Why don't you call the authorities? Wouldn't that be the smart thing to do? He said, I have called them. They think I'm nuts. That's why I'm calling you. So in any case, if you're a professional and somebody calls you up and wants to talk about the grassy knoll, I always advise people to hang up. Then there was the caller who was going to kill himself if the Daily News didn't change its liberal editorials. He was so upset by the editorials, he was talking about taking his own life. And I said, Mr. Jones, or whatever his name was, I said, don't do that. Cancel your subscription to the paper immediately. Your life is far more important than this newspaper. He said, you're serious about that? Of course. I said, I don't want you to die because of something I wrote. Stop reading the newspaper. You'll feel a lot better. So the man said he really appreciated the fact that I talked to him and gave him that point of view and said he would think about it. Then there was the time there was the governor of Alaska was on the phone, and he was really upset about an editorial we'd written. I forget what it was about now, and just lit into me and was all over me about the errors in the editorial, the errors in my approach to writing editorials, the various sins that the Daily News and lack of appreciation had committed for him over a long period of time. So I was sitting there, and I probably stood up after a while. I had a headset on, and Frank Urjevic worked with me at the time. He's the editorial page editor there now. And I said to the governor at some point, I said, Governor, we're getting way, way, way far away from where we need to be. We need to go back and talk about this editorial rather than talk about all these other sins that may or may not have been committed but are a long way from what we originally set out to talk about. Well, that even made him madder. You don't tell the governor, don't talk about this or don't talk about that. So then he really let me have it. Finally, the conversation came to an end, and I turned to Frank Gurdjieff, who was sitting next to me, and I said, so how'd I do? He said, well, you sounded real good, your voice was real good, but if you haven't noticed, you've turned purple and you look like you're about to have a heart attack. Then there are the emails, and one of the emails I remember is, I get emails from time to time from people who don't like my column, or don't like some political position I've taken, or just don't like me. And so they're determined to get it in there, and that's fine, they can send their emails. And I've sort of learned to either ignore them or write back if I feel like maybe I either want to. I'm not sure if this is, it may actually come from sort of a base motive on my part. I'll write back to them, thank you for taking the time to read my column. And they usually don't know what to think about that. So one day I did that with somebody who was very upset, and he sent me an email back and said, you know, that was really a nice note that you sent me, and I've reread your column, and now that I'm sober, it's not nearly as bad as I thought of it. Then there's the visitors. It's Friday afternoon at the Anchorage Daily News. I'm in my office trying to get the Saturday, Sunday, and Monday editorials and editorial pages out the door. This is sort of crunch time, 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. The front door is just about to close of the business office. The receptionist comes into my office and says, Mr. Carey, yes? There's a man downstairs with a large box of documents. He says he is not leaving until he talks to you. Well, it would be about his divorce, his child custody case, his veterans benefits, his arguments with the Bureau of Land Management over mining property he owned. Maybe the guy was living in his car. There'd be some tragedy in this. But usually these were domestic problems of his relationships with members of his family, his wife, his children, or other people. And they reminded me of Reynolds Price's devastating comment, Price being a novelist long associated with Duke University where I went to school. Reynolds Price said, the only thing more destructive than a tornado is a family. Now there's something to think about. But every once in a while, there's a news story. Somebody shows up, they're living in their car, and they do have a news story to tell you, or they're having difficulties with their family, or the BLM, or the Veterans Affairs, and they are a story. People, perhaps inspired by the movies and old news stories themselves, believe newspapers can be a force for justice. I attended a public event in New York. It was held at Barnes & Noble on 14th Street, and a variety of New York City or New York Times executives were there to talk about the paper, and Russell Baker was there, and he just published a book, a memoir, a very nice one. He's published several of them. Russell Baker was for a long time. Most of you would know him, was a columnist for the New York Times. And so I couldn't resist. In the Q&A, I asked him, so you're at the New York Times, what kind of telephone calls do you get as a columnist for the New York Times? Russell Baker said, I never answer the phone. People who call up the newspaper are crazy. What are you kidding? Then there's covering the legislature. This is my all-time favorite story for covering the legislature, and I better live up to it if I'm going to call it my all-time favorite story. I was down there one spring, and it was a beautiful day. Winter is finally over. The snow is all melted. The grass is starting to be turned green in front of the Capitol. Crocuses are starting to come up. There's the smell of spring is in the air, and people are in a good mood. It was lunchtime. People are coming and going in and out of the Capitol. Legislature's meeting, but this is time for a break. And windows are open as fresh air can get into the Capitol. And the State Employees Union had decided we're going to hold a big rally on the steps of the Capitol. They still do this. They've done this forever. In which we'll get a couple hundred people or 175 people there. And we will tell them our grievances or comment on the union negotiations that are going on. We'll have some kind of rally there in favor of for our side. So they did. And there were probably 175 people gathered on the steps of the Capitol. The union leader was standing in front, and he said, okay, folks, let's give it to them now. Let's tell them really what we want and when do we want it. Are you ready for that? Yeah, we're ready for it. So the union leader says, what do we want? And the 150 people or 175 people yell, money! And there was this silence that extended from the Capitol to Douglas Island. Nobody knew what to do with that. So the union leader sort of looked abashed in the front of the group, and the group was sort of mumbling, oh, what's that? I don't know. And finally, a union helper in the back thought he would try and bail out the union leader in the front and the whole group that was in the demo. He said, come on, folks, we know what we want. What we want is fairness, isn't it? Yeah, that's what we want. What do we want? Fairness. When do we want it now? And that proves to me conclusively that when you go to Juneau and ask people for things, you got to talk in code. Then there was the day that the Daily News, I was down there in the Daily News, front page spelled the word daily wrong. It was a personal disaster for me, a minor embarrassment that passed for the rest of the staff on the paper. It was daily was spelled D-A-I-Y, the day news. And I think just every legislator in the Capitol told me how foolish I was, how bad the paper looked, and why should they listen to me when we couldn't even spell daily right. And of course, I had to take it all. What was I going to say? I guess I finally was reduced to saying, I think we'll do better tomorrow. But in any case, this illustrates when I showed up in Juneau as representing the editorial page and, in effect, the executives of the paper, legislators had to get their unhappiness or anger or frustration out of their system. They would tell me that they were unappreciated, that I didn't understand how hard they'd been working, how well they were serving their constituents. They would go on and on and on and on about the lack of love and affection and appreciation that the paper was showing for them. Now, they had to get this out of their system. So I'd be down there 5 days, and this would last the first day and a half. And then finally, they'd say, okay, Mike, I said what I got to say. Why don't you come over to my office, and I'll try and tell you what's going on around here. And they would do that. But I did have one occasion where it was really pouring rain. This would have been March when it was very cold, cold rain. And I ran into Ramona Barnes, who's the Speaker of the House of Representatives, in front of the Capitol. And she just lit into me, telling me about all the sins of the Anchorage Daily News in some detail. It was pouring rain. This went on for 5 minutes, 8 minutes, 10 minutes. Finally, I was getting pretty wet. She was impervious to the rain. I said, Madam Speaker, I'm not taking this tongue lashing, but do you think we could continue it somewhere where it's dry? She just looked at me and said, oh, turned on her heel and stomped off. Despite this, I like covering the legislature. I enjoy the personalities, the process, and there's a lot at stake. But I think the legislature is like a baseball team. You have better players some years than in others. I'm not a particular fan of this current version of the legislature, but I will give Speaker Mike Chenault, who I see is talking to the Chamber of Commerce next week, credit. He must have some kind of magic invisible to me because of the way he keeps his troops in line and keeps getting reelected Speaker. it's quite an achievement. I want to say also a few words about corruption in the legislature, which got so much media attention, and I covered the trials as well, and of course I'd been covering the legislature off and on for years. The corruption started with Bill Allen, the chief executive of VECO, and he was a very interesting guy in both in retrospect at the time. Everything about him was outsized. He was a big, tall specimen to start with, and everything that he did was outsized. And if I didn't know he was corrupt and other people didn't, I knew he had too much influence in the legislature. You don't have to smell sulfur to know when the devil is in the room. Allen received endless deference because of his campaign contributions, the kind of money he could raise and raise in a hurry. I think he brought himself down, or may have brought himself down, or at least made himself more vulnerable because he split up with his lobbyist, Ed Dankworth, who was well known at one time here as a very powerful lobbyist. Allen was obvious in his asking for favors and his demands on legislators in a way that Ed Dankworth never would have been. And this is somewhat like advertising in the sense where the client decides, I don't need an advertising agency, I'm gonna do it all myself, and then of course gets himself in this trouble. Allen brought business practices to politics. It's quite clear that his business values corrupted politics. He had no interest in politics except as a vehicle to advance his corporate interests. He more or less said that when he testified on the witness stand. He said that he got into politics to compensate, to compete for contracts with the Alaska Native corporations, especially ASRC. The state, as you know, did very little to curb these conspirators. They were only arrested and tried and all the rest of it when the federal government stepped in. I wanted to say a few words about Ted Stevens, who I knew pretty well. And many people in this room would have known him too. He was smart, able, fully understood Congress. We had our moments of difference. There were times when he would holler at me over the telephone over some mistake I'd made in his judgment. But we always patched it up, and after he'd been yelling at me on the telephone, he'd say, "But you're okay, Mike," and then slam down the telephone. I admired him even when I disagreed with him, and it was sort of, in a certain sense, it was like dealing with my father. It was a man of a different generation who had a different way of doing things. If I fault him, I fault him for not being willing to give up Washington. If he'd stepped down at 80 instead of continuing, that would have been enough, but he didn't do it. Now, there were many occasions, or a number of occasions, when I wanted to interview him for some historical project about Fairbanks or some other part of Alaska life, and he'd say, "Well, have breakfast with me at some hotel." And so I would meet him there. And you really couldn't talk to him in that setting. We'd be at a table here, and there'd be a line of supplicants who would see him and want to talk to him. And they didn't want to interrupt for very long. They just wanted to interrupt for a minute. And eventually I wrote something in which I called Ted a frontier fertility god for the kind of wealth that he could bring to people. But the supplicants wouldn't leave him alone. They endlessly asked for just a little help, just a little help. They always said it was never for them, it was for the good of Alaska, it was for the good of some constituents or neighbors or friends that they had in other parts of Alaska, but they needed just a little help, which of course is a roundabout euphemistic way of saying federal money. I wondered if Ted Stevens tired of this, and I asked one of my friends who knew him well, and he said, "No, I don't think so. That's his job, and it sort of validates what he does." But every once in a while, even Ted Stevens would find that there were things he couldn't do for his constituents. There's a limit to his power in Washington, D.C., even as a frontier fertility god. One of my friends was present when he blew his stack at somebody and said, "Damn it, Jim, you gotta understand, I'm a senator, not a magician." I left out the profanity that went in there, but I think you get the point. A few lessons out of a lifetime of experience. These are observations, not part of Mike Carey's 12-step plan to get anywhere. I'm a great fan of Mad Men, the AMC television show about advertising in the 60s, 50s and 60s, and what went on in the big agencies of New York. Don Draper, the handsome protagonist of Mad Men, is somebody that interests me very much because he's so much more complicated. And it's true that he's got women everywhere, he drinks way too much, and he's a huckster for Madison Avenue, but he's a very reflective and interesting guy at times. Don Draper said, people tell us who they are. People tell us who they are, but we ignore what they say because we want them to be who we want them to be. What Don is telling us is we pursue illusions even when we have every opportunity to know better, and I know that from personal experience. And I would add, and I think Don would second me, nobody is the same person 24 hours a day. That'll give you a little pause to think about yourself for sure when you realize that. And Don, I hope, would agree with me when I say your emotions are like the weather, always changing. Don't mistake how you feel at 7 o'clock in the morning for how you're going to feel at 10 o'clock at night. And of course, when you're 18 or 20 years old, you think the way you're feeling a particular day, that's you for the rest of your life. Well, it's not true, and it's hard to learn that. Finally, I've learned people are who they are, and you have to take them the way they show up. This is really a plea for tolerance. If there's any virtue that I really have come to believe in, it is tolerance for our neighbors, for the people down the street, for the people who are around us. I'm going to stop with these maxims, lest I begin to sound like I write slogans for a fortune cookie factory. In closing, a few words about the Buddha. You may not know it, but perhaps the world's best known Buddhist, the Dalai Lama, has a home and a teaching center, a monastery in upstate New York, Ithaca, right down the road from where a college classmate of mine lives on Danby Road near Ithaca College. I walked by the place while visiting Ithaca last fall. The entrance, a classical Chinese gate painted a bright red, is festooned with prayer flags. They are colorful. The whole scene is charming. The Dalai Lama makes occasional public appearances in Ithaca. He makes speeches from time to time, and he takes questions. One of my friends said, I wasn't there to verify that, one of the questions that came to the Dalai Lama was this: Dalai Lama, what do you do when a mosquito is bothering you? The wise man said, well, first of all, I say, Brother Mosquito, would you please leave me alone? If that doesn't work, I try to move him away with my hand. And if that doesn't work, I just slap him, and that's the end of it. The monks in Ithaca regularly engage in prayer. And if you look on their website, you can see that the monks have prayed for cyberspace. Yes, the monks in Ithaca have prayed for cyberspace. They have prayed to reduce the negative elements in cyberspace and increase the positive elements. This is a prayer we can all join, whether or not we are Buddhists. Thank you.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans with Michael Carey, columnist for the Anchorage Daily News and host of Alaska Edition and running on Alaska Public Media. The Alaska Professional Communicators hosted Michael's talk entitled Everyone You Meet Is Your Teacher, What the Buddha Taught an Alaska Newspaper Man at Kinley's Restaurant in Anchorage on January 9th. Following Michael's presentation, he responded to questions from the audience. First, he was asked, what led you to New York and what did you think of it?
Oh, yeah. Well, my dad was a construction worker and a trapper, and he came from Minneapolis in 1937. My mother was from New York City, and she had gone to Hunter College, where she had a degree, and she'd gone to the Yale Nursing School. Both my parents worked, and we had a two-family income. The first time I was in New York was because our house burned down, and we needed to go someplace that was safe and clean, and this was during the Korean War. So my mother and my sister and I lived in New York City for a year. And all this stuff about Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac and Norman Mailer and Greenwich Village, it was sort of intoxicating to a kid from Fairbanks. If I couldn't play Major League Baseball, at least I could get to Greenwich Village. And I'd never met Allen Ginsberg, but I was in the same room with him, came into the bookstore, didn't buy anything from me, but I would see, these kind of people, you could see them around New York frequently. And It was just, I accepted that it was different, and there are people, I wasn't one of them, who I've known who've gone from here to a place like New York or Chicago, and they just say, I'm never going back again. These are the kind of people who won't go west of the Hudson River. They think that's the sticks to be in suburban New Jersey. Any case, that's sort of another aspect of my story. Anybody else? Yes, Jeannie Green. The question is, how do I see rural Alaska, given my experience? I think that the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act is one of the great successes of my lifetime. It has done remarkable things for Alaska's native people. Not all of them, not individually necessarily, but for a large number of them, that's given them opportunities. Part of the question is now is what comes next? Can small and medium-sized villages be sustained? There are people who want to live there. Are the resources to sustain them? And especially if Alaska goes into a period of scarcity, that is with state spending and perhaps also with federal spending, what might that mean for rural Alaska? But I mean, there are people who live in rural Alaska who are going to live there for eternity. That it's been made clear. Yes, please. The question is, how are younger or Alaskans getting adequate news from the alternative sources of newspaper or information if they don't necessarily read the newspaper or watch conventional television? I suspect this is probably one of those things where anything you say is true, that there are a number of people who are really assiduous in gathering information and are very well informed, and there are others who are not. One of the problems with the internet, as everybody in here knows, is there's not a lot of vetting that goes on, so that rumors and things that are completely untrue flourish in this kind of environment. You have to develop a certain amount of sophistication to sort those things out. The other thing, of course, in this environment is, if you say anything stupid on television, it'll follow you around for the rest of your life. And I have proven that to my satisfaction without doubt. I have people asking me, I was at the Republican convention in St. Paul when Sarah Palin was nominated, and I made a couple of comments there that I regretted. I mean, they weren't indictable offenses, but I sort of wish they'd go away and I wouldn't get email questions about them, you know, this many years later. One more. It's sort of a mixed bag. The question I had was on the Alaska Edition, we have both reporters and opinion makers on the show. Some of might be columnists, there are others. Paul Jenkins is a good example of that. And what are sort of the limits for people who are reporting the news to make it, to commenting on the news in a very opinionated way? I don't know. In some ways, our show is sort of, it follows in the wake of Washington Week and other shows which try to establish that kind of balance and have some of the country's John Harwood of the Washington Post is on there, or the New York Times. There are any number of them, David Wessel, the Wall Street Journal, all these reporters who somehow can manage to fight their way through that thicket. And that's something that we try to do probably with a certain amount of I hope not too much confusion to the viewers, but it does happen from time to time.
The last question from the audience was, what is your most memorable interview?
My most memorable interview. Well, this is actually a television story. I was the host of Running and have been, and I've been doing Running for a number of years. And we had Vic Coring was on Running for Re-election, and Pat Carney, who had a Democrat, Vic was the Republican, Pat was the Democrat, who had previously been in the legislature, and it was very important to him, and he liked it. But the district had changed. At some point, he'd been defeated. It was very long shot that he'd be able to get in with Vic, who was well known for all of his work with constituents and was very successful with that. So we're on there, and it's a table that's smaller than that at that point. And Vic Coring and Carney are going back and forth, and Pat Carney is saying, or Vic is challenging Pat to sign a pledge that he will never raise taxes as long as he lives. This is one of the very conservative groups in, I think, New Hampshire, or maybe somewhere in the East, sends these out to people. When you take this, Grover Norquist has something like this. You take a pledge never to raise taxes as long as you live. And Vic kept baiting Pat Carney by waving this piece of paper in front of him and daring him to sign it. Finally, Pat Carney had enough of this, and he said, "Representative Corey, I'll sign that piece of paper if you shove it where the sun doesn't shine." This is on live television. This is not being taped. I thought, oh man, what do I do now? And I remembered the wisdom of my colleague, Steve McDonald, who just said, denial is an important part of live television. It didn't happen. Just keep going. And I am very indebted to my dear colleague, Steve, for that wisdom, because I just said, "Representative Coring, your response, please." And he deplored the fact that the campaign had taken such a personal tone, hoped that we could get back to the issues and not be so personal, won re-election, and went to jail. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Michael Carey, columnist for the Anchorage Daily News and host of Alaska Edition and running on Alaska Public Media. The Alaska Professional Communicators hosted Michael's talk entitled "Everyone You Meet Is Your Teacher, What the Buddha Taught an Alaska Newspaper Man," recorded at Kinley's Restaurant in Anchorage on January 9, 2014. Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online anytime at alaskapublic.org. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Platt. Thanks for listening.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Thank you.